ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing classic cinema. As always, I am your host, Kristen Lopez. This week marks the start of Tickleween. Thank you to listener Jerry Roberts for that amazing suggestion, and I'll be talking with writer and animator Nia Alavizos about Henri Georges Clouzot's Diabolique. Depending on who you talk to, 1955's Diabolique, or Les Diaboliques, translates to The Devils or The Fiends. Either way, it follows two women in a boys' school with murder on their mind. Christina is the headmistress of the school, played by Clouzot's wife Vera. She's married to the school's principal Michel, played by Paul Maurice, whose mistress is Nicole, a school teacher who works at the same establishment as all of them, played by Simone Signoret. Hopefully you've worked out the love triangle based on my description. Michel is emotionally and physically abusive to both of the women in his life, so they decide to band together to kill him, concocting an elaborate scheme that ends up with his body dumped in the school swimming pool. However, Michel's body isn't discovered right away. It actually isn't discovered at all. And once the children at the school mention seeing him walking the grounds, the two women start to wonder if maybe he isn't truly dead and is coming back to seek revenge. Diabolique is easily regarded as one of Clouzot's masterpieces, alongside his 1953 film Wages of Fear. He's considered the French equivalent to the master of suspense himself, Alfred Hitchcock, and that's caused his work to fly under the radar. Diabolique is based on Pierre Boulez and Thomas Narzajak's novel She Who Was No More. Hitchcock actually missed out on making this movie by mere minutes, failing to secure the rights before Clouzot did. Boulez and Narzajak ended up writing a special novel just for Hitchcock, From Among the Dead, which became his masterpiece, Vertigo. Both directors have a lot of similarities. They were meticulous planners, storyboarding their films prior to filming down to the letter, and they tended to have difficulties with their actors. Simone Signoret Clouzot and Vera Clouzot ended up mimicking the hostilities the characters felt within the film by the end. None of them were speaking to each other by the time the film wrapped, and Signoret was very vocal afterwards about how unhappy the relationship was with everybody. Clouzot's work erred on the side of the bleak in comparison to Hitchcock, and there are shades of Edgar Allan Poe's Telltale Heart within the story of two women presumably haunted by the man they've murdered. You can also see a lot of film noir, as well as some of the callbacks to 1940s haunted house gothic thrillers akin to The Uninvited or The Haunting. The film divided critics upon release in 1955, but it was a success in both its native France and the US. Outside of being a landmark film for the horror genre, Diabolique is considered the basis of Hitchcock's Psycho, complete with the end credits anti-spoiler warning, and it inspired later thrillers like Peeping Tom. Several directors have homaged the film, most famously Stanley Kubrick, whose bathtub sequence in 1980's The Shining mimics the ending of this movie. In 1967, Curtis Harrington had Simone Signoret reprise her Nicole role in a thinly veiled B-movie version of this film called Games. Other remakes include 1974's made-for-TV feature Reflections of Murder with Tuesday Weld, and 1996's official remake of the movie starring Sharon Stone and Isabella Gianni, which is considered one of the lesser film remakes to come out of the early 90s, when a lot of 1940s, 1950s films were being remade with a lot more sex included, which didn't end up making them classics in comparison to their original counterparts. Everyone, those spoilers have come out in previous episodes. It's worth mentioning, especially for this film, that we are going to be talking about the end of the movie in our main discussion, so if you don't want any spoilers to Diabolique, probably fast forward to the end. My special guest is Nia Olivezos. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, Olivezos, I guess.
Well, Nia, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I work at Renegade Animation at the moment. I'm working on the Tom and Jerry show as a production coordinator. But I also really love old films and animation because I grew up on a diet of classic films and animation, all thanks to TCM. So I just love films and storytelling. So I'm really happy to be here. And I love blogging as well.
Diabolique does not get a lot of love, and it is Halloween. Why did you suggest this? What's your history with the film?
Well, I love French films, and I love just a good murder film. And there's one that reminds me of Hitchcock a lot. And like you said, I'm always surprised that people don't discuss it as much as they should. So I wanted to at least get the opportunity to talk about it.
I've watched this a couple of times. I think this was maybe the second or third time that I've watched it all the way through. I want to say the first time I actually heard about this was when Bravo did their scariest horror movie moments, nice. And they had this. I would say so far, the Hitchcock allusions, if you listen to the intro, they're important because Hitchcock missed buying the rights to this by minute, so this almost became a Hitchcock film, but it's influenced so many other filmmakers and movies, which we'll touch on outside influences in a second, that there's a lot to digest. The first thing we should discuss is this necessarily a horror film? It's considered a landmark horror film, but I think if most people watch this without knowing that, would you think that this is a horror film?
I would say so. It's not like a slasher film, or there's no monsters or zombies. The psychological effect that draws on you throughout the film that I think comes with the horror genre?
I would agree. I think that, if anything, the ghostly elements are what keep this going. I mentioned in my introduction that there's some Edgar Allan Poe, which we'll discuss in a second, but it's that telltale heart type of story where Nicole and Christina are essentially being haunted by what they've done, and then it takes this literal manifestation when the little boy says that he's seen the principal wandering around and he's in the photos.
The body goes missing.
So you do have that kind of creeping terror element before the actual climax reveals itself. But I see a lot of film noir in this as well.
Oh, for sure. Especially with Nicole's the mistress, especially with her. Because she's sort of like the femme fatale next to Christine's character. And sort of this subplot that was in the book about them sort of being romantically related, but just with Nicole's relationship to Christine and her bringing her into murdering her husband, definitely femme fatale.
Yeah, definitely. Simone Signoret, who plays Nicole, definitely has that femme fatale. She's got the blonde hair, she smokes cigarettes.
The glasses.
She wears sunglasses indoors because she's been smacked around, but also because, you know, you just assume that she's cool. As any good film noir, they plot this murder, they're in it together, they turn on each other, and they have that back and forth. The bumbling detective trying to...
For no reason, you know?
Tries to solve the mystery, and they almost get away with it, which is very much in the vein of Double Indemnity and other noirs. It's understandable why the French embraced film noir so much, because I think that it really ties into their horror as well. But you did mention the lesbian subplot, which was an element of the novel that obviously they had to remove. I don't know if they removed that necessarily for U.S. audiences, because I know in France they were
definitely more permissive.
Oh, yeah, much more open towards the sexuality and stuff.
Yeah, I think you see a little bit. It's funny, if you guys have been long-term listeners to the podcast, this is probably, like, the third movie I've discussed that has homoerotic or at least some sort of... Yeah, we talked about Ben-Hur, and we talked about The Killing, the Stanley Kubrick film, and this is, I think, this is their third movie that has same-sex allusions to it. I swear this is not intentional.
That's okay, you just gotta keep rolling with it.
I think you see that a little bit, the concept of them going on vacation with each other.
And the little schoolboys, they're always together. I bet they're drunk.
And if you've seen something like The Children's Hour with Audrey Hepburn and Shirley MacLaine that would come out about a decade later. School teachers, we always got that bum rap
exactly.
of being lesbians.
And they, like, sort of live in the same compound, so it's hard not to get that hint.
And they have this sort of heterosexual buffer because they share the same man,
yes,
essentially.
Exactly. And they're pretty open about it as well. I'm not trying to hide the fact that Nicole's the headmaster's mistress.
I think one of them says she's the mistress, and then Christina is the wife.
Yes.
And she's also the one with the purse strings because she has the money.
Oh, exactly.
So you have a lot of these, it's not necessarily permissive, but it's far more open regarding adultery than I think a Hollywood film would have been. It's, I can only imagine how this would translate as a studio film in America. They would have definitely watered down a lot.
I think so. I think they would have been at least maybe divorced.
They would have been divorced and probably living under the same roof.
Yes.
Then it would just turn into a screwball comedy.
Yeah, exactly. Put Cary Grant in the mix.
It'd be The Awful Truth, only with a slight case of, like, arsenic and old
exactly.
ways.
Exactly. Katharine Hepburn as well, you know?
There'd be a leopard, and he'd probably eat the body or something. Something. That's Hollywood. Take that idea. We're giving you...
After this, I'm going to start the screenplay on that. Thank you.
I think it's one of those movies that we've seen with Hollywood that women tend to get a bum rap.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those, it's a very small, set-bound type of movie.
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot of characters. And Christina and Nicole are very much drawn as two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how I felt about that.
Christina's sort of the faithful wife, super religious.
She's super religious. She wears pigtails and little girl clothes.
She's like a child, and she has, like, a shrine in her room. And then there's Cole, who's the femme fatale, who's sleeping around with the headmaster and very open about her relationship and even suggesting the murder in the first place.
There's that Madonna whore element
mm-hmm.
that I don't necessarily know, without trying to spoil the ending, there are no winners, obviously,
yeah.
which you know right off the bat, but I think it's hard for me to really root for any of the characters because one of them is so pious,
mm-hmm.
and the other one is so calculating.
I don't know.
Was that difficult for you?
It was at first. I had to go with Christina, just because she's just been battered around, and then her husband's an a-hole. She's stuck with him there. Kind of just wanted her to get away with it just because he was so horrible. I don't like Nicole very much.
Well, Nicole, I do like the element of her being the one to tell, she writes the little script for her to say when she calls the husband and tells him she wants a divorce. And you kind of think it's like a sister's doing it for themselves type of relationship. She's trying to bolster her confidence. Christina's also the one with the moral center. So as the plot progresses, she's the one who can't handle the fact that they haven't found the body yet.
Mm-hmm. But, like, what they have done, and then what they have gotten from it, just living their lives and carrying on, you know? I've always wondered.
Yeah, that's where I think the lesbian subplot needed to, and maybe that's why the ending is the way it is,
mm-hmm.
because you do wonder what they're going to do after they're absolved of this crime.
Exactly. Maybe Christina would have continued on at the school as the headmistress. She really loved the children, and that came with her, like, inheritance, because I know she was wealthy. And
part of the reason why you understand the husband has his own motives. I think that would have been interesting to see where their eventual plan is, because it does kind of come off as hackneyed
mm-hmm.
that they have this plan prepared to a fault. It's almost like a closed system. You're never really sure what they're going to do once they get
exactly.
away with it.
Are they just going to drive off to the sunset? I don't know.
They're going to be Thelma and Louise, yeah. only French.
Driving off a cliff.
We mentioned Edgar Allan Poe, the Telltale Heart
mm-hmm.
moments. You brought up Hitchcock. There's a lot of Hitchcockian elements that they've said that Hitchcock kind of borrowed from this. The anti-spoiler warning at the end, which we saw in Psycho.
Oh, yeah.
The red herrings, the bumbling detective. I haven't seen any other Clouseau films, which we were going to do La Corbeau,
yeah.
But it was a bit difficult to find online.
I saw the Corbeau, but it's been a few years.
Off the top of your head, is there any similarities between the two?
Just right now, I know just scandalous element. I know in Le Corbeau, there's letters floating around, and
it's a very cynical film, I think. But there's stray bits of humor. Specifically the detective, which I always find that when Christina goes to the morgue, and the receptionist is trying to trick her by saying, what does he have, a brave, dry humor that I could belittlingly say is very French.
Exactly. And I even like two men who work at the school.
Call pretty much to make one of the kids the scapegoat to find the body. She throws the keys into the pool. And A, that pool looks like it's filled with all sorts of horrible amoebas and diseases. That kid's definitely contracted some sort of skin issue or hepatitis. Mm-hmm. He finds the lighter, the principal's lighter. That
really
pool is murky as can be. You are not going to be able to find anything in that. Obviously, this inspired Hitchcock, Psycho, and inspired Vertigo, although I'm one of the few people that does not like Vertigo, so some people would say that I am way too harsh on that. But this also inspired the film Peeping Tom. Let's talk about the ending, because the ending is essentially what this film is famous for, and I do think, as enjoyable as the film is, it's almost in service to that ending. We know that Christina and Nicole have killed their husband / lover, respectively. And we know that there's the possibility that either he's been resurrected, or he was never dead to begin with.
Or someone maybe took his body? Someone
exactly.
Someone conspiring against them, who knows?
But we find out at the end, Christina has slowly started to mentally deteriorate because she can't take the guilt anymore of the fact that they haven't found him. And she's asleep one night, goes into her bathroom, and finds her husband's body in the tub.
Yes.
He gets up, which causes her to flip out so much that she gives herself a heart attack.
Yes.
Because she has a weak heart, and she effectively dies. You find out that her husband was never dead, that he was conspiring with Nicole to kill her off and take all her money, but in the final seconds, the detective shows up and says,
he comes literally out of the shadows. He's like, not today.
Says, I've caught you, you guys are going to jail, and you think that everything has been fixed, law and order has been reestablished, only for the same little boy who said he saw the principal, says that he has seen Christina.
And then she gave him his slingshot back?
Yes, and that she sent him on his way, and everybody says that he couldn't have seen her, and he says that he did, and that's how it ends. Now, let's break that down. The twist is essentially what people remember. Him coming out of the bathtub as some type of resurrected zombie corpse and scaring his wife to death.
Mm-hmm.
I love that ending, because the concept of being frightened to death is real and very terrifying to me.
Same to me as well. And I just love how they used her obvious heart condition. Like, that was the main ploy. Like, you know, they could have just jumped out of a closet a few times, you know, been like, boo, easily could have scared her. But they went through this huge ordeal of, you know, pretending to be dead, committing a murder, just to have her seem like she naturally died of a heart attack.
It could play like a red herring that, she's got a weak heart. But the movie really does a slow mental torture on her. Everything wears her down to the point where, conceivably, you could believe that the stress of having a missing husband would have done her in.
Mm-hmm.
It's only by sheer happenstance there's the red herring of the body in the seine that they think could be him, which causes her to go to the morgue, which causes her to meet the detective who ends up reestablishing law and order at the end. It is sheer luck. I think Woody Allen plays with similar themes in Match Point, which I don't know if he took this movie as an inspiration, but it plays very similarly. Everything, I think, is underscored by that final scene, by the detective literally showing up in the shadows to the point where I wanted the principal or Nicole to say, how the hell did you get in here?
Yeah, like, what the hell are you doing here, dude?
I'm pretty sure you're trespassing. It's midnight or whatever time it is, and you're here. And I think that is where I wonder if that was intentional for a U.S. audience, because the code was still in effect, and you couldn't have villains win.
Exactly, and it's sort of the deus ex machina.
But it's very much so, yeah.
Even if you look at the inspector, I'm pretty sure he figured it out earlier on. And you remember the one scene when he's sort of smoking the cigar and he's watching her sleep? I'm pretty sure then he sort of figured out, hey, you know, he's not missing, he's not dead. And then that's when she told him that she killed him, and then he's probably like, oh, something more sinister is going on.
It does leave you to question, because we talk about how much of a dick the principal is.
Mm-hmm.
But you start to wonder, at least I wondered, because the movie opens with Nicole having a black eye because he's slapped her around. And you start to wonder if that was true or if that was just more fuel for the fire to get Christina on her side. There's never really an answer for that.
It could have been just makeup. Could have been part of their plan that they've probably been thinking about for God knows how long. It's also super interesting to think about.
You know, most movies, I think, kind of begin and end as they're presented to us. This leaves a lot on the periphery outside the frame of the actual film.
Mm-hmm.
The final moment with the little boy. What's your theory? Do you think that it's an actual ghost or something else?
That's what you think, because you know the inspector figured it out. So what if he could have possibly told Christina, hey, your husband's not dead, why don't you pretend? But I don't think it's in that ballpark. I think maybe she did die and it's just her ghost haunting the school, because you know that's what was part of her inheritance, and it's a very spiritual thing. She was religious.
Yeah, it really does play on those old haunted house films of the 40s, something like The Uninvited, where you have these characters that are so bound to a place.
Mm-hmm.
And it does leave that door open to maybe the supernatural has been present all the time, and the characters just aren't aware of that.
And it would even add to that horror appeal that it probably is her ghost just roaming the schools now. And then she was always kind, so she can just be kind, especially to that poor kid who's always put into the corner.
It's funny almost that we end with that little boy going back into the corner, because everybody's leaving. And I was
poor kid
wondering, I'm like, wait, is he just gonna stay there and hopefully somebody is just gonna come pick him up?
I love how he accepts it too. He just starts walking as soon as they start questioning him, because you know he's gonna have to end up in that poor corner.
Kind of returning to that dry humor of you can laugh about it, but then it's also very sad.
I know. What I really liked on my second rewatch was that you never really saw the husband die. And it's just very, like, cleverly done, especially the staging by Clouseau. Because, you know, you see him drowning, but not really drowning. And then she covers him. And everything like that is just so expertly done that the first time you watch it, you're not questioning it. Because you're just like, oh, yeah, that dude's dead. But the second time, you're just like, oh, you just notice the smaller, the hints, which is what I really, really love the second time watching.
It plays out so deliberately, where they put him in the tub, and then she has the whole thing with the tablecloth to go over the top, and the statue to weigh him down. And you're noticing as how it's all cut, and the fact that Christina leaves the room at one point and comes back. The first go-around, you're taking what's presented to you and kind of rationalizing a lot of it.
Exactly.
And the second time, you're trying to figure out the magician's trick, almost.
Yes, that's what I was trying to figure out. But the first time, you're sort of looking at it through Christina's perspective, because you're never in the bathroom alone with Nicole. And even Nicole's performance the second time around, it's just a huge act, and it's just so fake when you look at her being flustered and upset that the body's gone, and it's just so well done.
Clouseau worried that he always said that he wished he didn't give Simone Signoret the script with the ending included, because he felt that her performance essentially gave away the ending and her part in it, which I don't necessarily think you see until the final act. I mean, I can't remember if my first watch, if I noticed this or not. I did notice in the second that when she has that moment, when she tells Christina, I'm leaving, you should come with me, I'm gonna go, I did think, knowing that I knew the end, I was kind of, you can kind of see it breaking down there.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, I don't think she gives it away.
No, definitely not with the first watch, which is the most important one. Because I honestly just thought it was a ghost. So I was like, I don't even know where the heck this is going the first time I watched it.
But if anything, I think in the first go-round, I thought that he wasn't dead, but I didn't think that he was working with Nicole at all. I thought that he was just screwing with both of them.
That's true. I had no idea. I was like, could be a ghost, could be someone plotting against them. Who knows? The second rewatch, she was just noticed when she starts to put the thoughts in Christina's head. The first thought, oh, let's murder him. The second thought, oh no, his body's gone. Just leave him there in the pool. It's just so perfect.
I did feel bad that we can't have the feminism winning the day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it still kind of falls back on the, oh, killed the wife and now she gets the man. Which is kind of why I think the catharsis, I don't really care for how the ending is solved, but she does deserve her comeuppance for screwing over another lady, but...
Oh yeah, I'm glad she ended up in jail, and her husband too.
I was waiting for kind of a big Double Indemnity-esque bloody ending where everybody dies.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Or, like, there's, like, a stabbing or...
Yeah, this is one of the rare, unlike most noirs, or most horror films, really, there isn't a big bloody massacre. Unlike the last episode when we talked about the killing and how many people died in that film, the only payoff is through Law and Order and the justice system.
Mm-hmm.
They go to jail, which I think might be a bit of a letdown for audiences who are used to... somebody dying at the end and essentially getting their comeuppance through death. It is intriguing that the French see the justice system as the ultimate means of getting one's revenge.
It is, especially when murder is involved and infidelity.
It's a double-edged sword. You're kind of like, that's it? But at the same time, it's unique in that I think most people are used to the big, bombastic, bloody ending.
Exactly, but I always enjoy the simplicity of the storytelling and the fact that it's more psychological. Slow, very slow pacing, but just the slow, steady beats as it leads to the big moment is really great.
Overall, I really love Diabolique. I think it's a very clever film. It obviously inspired so many other directors. Hitchcock, I don't think, would have the competitive edge if he wasn't trying to best Clouseau, even though their paths were completely different. Do you think the ending hypes it a bit more? I think a lot of the movie's plot is in service to the end. But regardless of that, it's a very, very smart horror noir, which I don't really know if you can get another movie that blends the horror element and the ghost story with film noir to make something that's a lot of sense, but at the same time is so otherworldly. The acting's great. It's creepy. It's essentially watching The Innocents mixed with Double Indemnity, which are two movies.
The Haunting as well, maybe.
It's like if you watch The Haunting with Detour or something, which are two movies that should not be combined. Nia, what are your overall thoughts on Diabolique?
Well, it's one of my favorite films. And I just love the simplicity of it. I love how it's very French and is very scandalous for the time it was made in. But I also just love, obviously, what makes the film is the ending. And I just love the slow and the steady beats leading up to it, and the acting, the performance, the directing. It's just, it reminds me of like a classical painting. And it's just sort of the last great classic French film before the French New Wave took into place.
Exactly. You watch this, and then you watch something like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg or The Young Girls of Rochefort, something like that. By the 60s, the French were very peppy.
They just were over the old studio system and how everything seemed so fake and staged out. And I just love how this was sort of the last big hurrah, especially from Clouseau. Oh, even the second rewatch is so well done.
Although now I'm just thinking of doing Catherine Deneuve December.
That'd be great. It's a good idea.
Sure, we're putting that on the list for the future.
Yes.
Let me know what you think about Diabolique. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. Nia, I'd like to thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. It's very fun. Love to do it again.
Well, definitely will. Once again, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
Let's see. I'm on Twitter. You can find me at Aloofness. It's spelled Aloofness.
Before we close out, I do have a listener email from Joe Gorbsky. He says, I enjoyed your podcast discussing The Killing, which is a favorite of mine. I do have to take exception to one comment. You said you were surprised there was not a bloodbath at the end. Go back and rewatch the scene where Val breaks in on the gang waiting for Johnny. The ensuing shootout leaves everyone but George spread around the room dead.
Granted, the film is in black and white, so the effect is muted, but if you add color to the scene, it would make for a bloody mess. As black and white goes, the scene did a pretty good job of creating a massacre. Hope to see you do more film noir in the future. Best wishes, Joe. Joe, thank you so much for emailing me, and you are very correct. I can only imagine what this would look like filmed in Technicolor. 1956 audiences would have probably been vomiting in their seats at how much blood would be around the room, so you are definitely right on that. Thank goodness we don't have the colorizing process on this movie, because A, colorizing is horrible, and B, it definitely would have shocked audiences a lot more. You can get away with so much with black and white because you just monochromatic coloring, and it's a lot more subtle imagery. You have to really look for it. So you're definitely on par there. I will definitely be doing more film noir in the future. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode where I kind of made the argument for Diabolique being kind of a horror film noir hybrid. I don't know if anybody's ever done that before, but I consider that a horror film noir hybrid. So again, everybody feel free to email me. I definitely appreciate the emails. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please feel free to leave a rating and review, which gives me a bit more traction and more listeners because I have a higher prominence on iTunes. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysandclassicfilm.com. If you don't think you're getting enough Tickleween this month, you can definitely stop by Journeys and Classic Film, where I'm doing a 31 Days of Halloween tribute to the Universal Classic Monsters. So I'm going to have reviews from The Invisible Man, to the Dracula series, and all manner of Universal horror films in between. The podcast is also on Twitter now at ticklish_biz, so feel free to contact me there. Next time, I'm going to be talking with Todd Liebenau about the Frankenstein series, specifically the first three Frankenstein films. So Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, Son of Frankenstein. Be sure to tune into TCM every Sunday this month because Frankenstein is actually their monster of the month. So you can follow along and be prepared for the upcoming episode. And if you enjoyed my interview with William V. Madison, the mini-sode from last week, I will be doing another mini-sode next week in honor of Trailblazing Women. I am going to be interviewing Carrie Beecham and Ileana Douglas. So you'll be getting those in honor of the upcoming Trailblazing Women special, which everybody should watch, support women in cinema. So until next time, we will be continuing Tickleween.